Well, I thank the organizers for inviting me to speak. This is a report on preliminary explorations of a new problem that I'm currently working on. Nothing's been written about it. You won't find it on QuantPH. It's also kind of an odd problem. It may not bear any fruit. Maybe it will. I don't know. I hope that some of the ideas will be interesting anyway. And here's the title, Parallel Transport in Entangled Ring. And I'll basically explain the title as we go along. Let me go through the outline. That will help. This is a talk, really, that fits into the category of problems on sharing entanglement. It's a question of how can several objects share entanglement with each other. Okay, that's really where this belongs. What this will do. And then you see the next thing to talk about is lattice gauge theory. Okay, that's why it's an odd problem. Okay, because that's why it's sort of in a different color. You don't expect that, right, in this talk. And it would expect it even less if John Preskill hadn't already blazed that trail earlier this week. But anyway, it comes in here in a different way. Basically, I'm looking for an analogy between a certain aspect of lattice gauge theory and these entangled quantum systems. Okay, and I'll explain that as we get there. And the particular case that I can deal with, because other lattices are too hard, is a simple ring. So that's what the work actually is. Okay, so let's get started. And so part one of the talk, so there are four parts of the talk, as you saw there. Part one is sharing entanglement. Okay, and let me just recall a couple of results about this. Here are three qubits, A, B, and C. And it's a fact that if A and B are in a completely entangled state, say a singlet state, then neither of them can be at all entangled with C. That's quite clear, because if they're in a singlet state, in particular, they're in a pure state, and if either of them were entangled with C, then they would be in a mixed state because of the entanglement with C. So that can happen. And similarly, of course, if A and C are completely entangled, then they can't be entangled with B. And sometimes this has been called the monogamy of entanglement. It's a good name for it, except that it doesn't really work, because if A and B are partly entangled, or even mostly entangled with each other, then A and C can be somewhat entangled with each other. But if we use this, this C is not the same as this C. This C is concurrence. It's a measure of entanglement. It goes from 0 to 1 for qubits. It's only for qubits, from 0 to 1. And there's this trade-off between this entanglement and this entanglement. Okay, as one goes up, the other must go down. And here it's expressed by this formula. See, the sum of the squares is less than or equal to 1. It's a pretty tight formula in the sense inequality, in the sense that for any C's that satisfy the equality, you can find a quantum state that has those C's. So it actually makes the C squared kind of a nice measure of entanglement from that perspective. On a similar line, we've conjectured that the same thing happens when A is there still qubits. A is trying to be entangled with lots of other qubits. Basically, A has one unit of entanglement to work with, and it can split it however we want. That's what we think. And again, for any set of C's for which this equals 1, you can find a quantum state which has those C's. So if this is correct, it's as tight as you can get. And there's we have some numerical evidence that's true. We haven't proved it, though, which is a little bit frustrating. Okay, but I haven't told you what the definition of concurrence is. I should tell you that, just to be complete. It's a simple measure of entanglement. Just for qubits, A, B, C, D are coefficients in this two-qubit state. If A, D is equal to B, C, then that's a separate, that factorizes. And in fact, if and only if A, D is equal to B, C, it factorizes. So it makes sense to say the difference between those would be a measure of entanglement, absolute value, times 2 to make it go from 0 to 1. So that's for pure states, it's very simple. For mixed states, it's also pretty simple. You have a mixed state, which is a mixture of pure states. You just take the average concurrence of the pure states, and you minimize over all the possible ensembles of pure states that represent that mixed state. So that's the end of the definition. And it also is nice to work with, because there's a formula exact formula for concurrence. You give give me a density matrix of 2 qubits, and you can just plug it through this formula, and it spits out the concurrence, spits out this number. You take your density matrix, you take its complex conjugate, this is sigma y cross sigma y, so you multiply these together to get another 4 by 4 matrix, find its eigenvalues, take the square roots, and then take this combination, and if it's negative, you just call the concurrence 0, and if it's not negative, then that's the concurrence. I mean, it's simpler than finding the minimum, anyway. It's maybe not all that simple, but it's certainly simpler than finding the minimum. Now, having done that, I have to say that you're not going to see concurrence for the rest of this talk. But I needed to say it since I referred to it. Oh, no, you will see it. You see it right now. Here it comes. Here it comes. One more entanglement sharing result before we move to part two of the talk. It's a different kind of entanglement sharing. Suppose you have a ring of qubits, okay? And you want them all to be entangled with their nearest neighbors, okay? It's not even obvious, I don't think, at first glance, that that's even possible. Because you look at these two here, you find they have a density matrix that's obtained by tracing out the others. And that density matrix may be separable. But in fact, you can make them all entangled. And you can ask, well, then how entangled can they be? And we believe this is the maximum. There's a lot of good evidence that that is the number that's the best you can do. Okay, and this is the kind of thing that I'm talking about in this talk. I'm talking about entangled rings. And this ring is as nearest neighbor entangled as it could possibly be under no constraints. But I'm going to add a constraint. I'm going to add a kind of a twist. I'm going to force it to be twisted in a certain sense that I'll explain. And also, that's the essential difference. I'm going to add this constraint and see how entangled it can be under the constraint. But also, this is less essential, but it's necessary for presenting any results for now. The ring will be of rebits, not qubits. Okay, rebit is like quantum bit that lives in a two-dimensional real vector space instead of a complex vector space. Okay, this is the symbol for that. And so in American Sign Language, I think, it's a plane, as opposed to blocks here. Okay. And I'm doing that just because it makes the problem easier. That's practice. That's practice for going up to real qubits. Okay, and now we move to part two of this. Sorry?
You're going up to
complex qubits. Those are qubits are complex qubits.
But you're real qubits as opposed to
rebits. Rebits. I think that Carl Caves and others coined that word, and I like it. It's a good word. Okay, so part two is lattice gauge theory. So we'll get back to the ring, but here's lattice gauge theory. So this is, I've been reading about it. It's really cool stuff. This is how they do gauge theory on a lattice. They discretize space-time. You see the ethereal colors indicate that this is space-time and not the red and brown that we had for the rebits and so on. So to make you understand, this is a different system. I'm going to make an analogy. This is a different thing. This is space-time. These are points in space-time. They're not qubits. And they make it Euclidean by using imaginary time, so that the time dimension is similar to the space dimensions. Now, a configuration of a gauge field, okay, is basically consists of a bunch of little rotations that you assign to each link, okay, going from here to here. There's a rotation. You need the rotation suppose you want to compare a vector here representing a matter field to a corresponding vector here. You can't compare them unless you move this one to there so they can be compared. And you do need to compare if you do want to do something like take a derivative. So this little rotation tells you how to move this vector to here. It's called parallel transport. So that's where the title of the talk comes from. And these little parallel transporters, these little rotations, are a field configuration. Okay, this assignment of rotations to links is the gauge field configuration. Or you could say history instead of configuration, since there's time in there. And each of these little U's, these rotations, is an element of the gauge group, which for electrodynamics is U1, just a phase. And for chromodynamics, it's an element of SU3. This phase business is familiar from the Aharonov-Bohm effect, right? You move an electron around a region of magnetic field, it picks up a phase. That's the kind of phase we're talking about. I have one more transparency about lattice gauge theory. And this one is the one that emphasizes the one point that I particularly want to bring out. Probability distribution over field configuration. So you have all these possible field configurations. Each one is a bunch of little rotations assigned to links. Consider any little plaquette, little elementary square in the lattice. And you can consider the little link parallel transporters around the plaquette. You don't have to get back to where you started. This combination need not be the identity. So this is some characteristic of the field configuration. In fact, these link UPs, these U's that are associated with plaquettes, carry all the information about the field that's gauge invariant, that doesn't depend on little rotations at the vertices. Also, now there's an action associated with a field configuration. And it just depends on these U's. And basically, the farther the U's are from the identity, the bigger the action. So the more twist you have in your field, the bigger the action. And the field pays a price for that, because the bigger the action, the smaller the probability, see, E to the minus action, when you take averages. So field configurations that have a big average, big action, and these actions are positive things, non-negative thing, has a bigger action because of more twist, it has a smaller probability. So the most likely field configurations are the ones that don't have any twist at all. So I want to call this the action cost of twisting. And that's the main thing I want to get out of lattice gauge theory. But it's beautiful because this turns gauge theory into statistical mechanics by doing it this way. And now I'm back to qubits and things like that. So I'm looking for an analogy. So you see we're back to the down-to-earth colors here. These really are qubits or rebits or something like that. And they really are arranged physically on this lattice. And there is no imaginary time. There's not even any real time here. This is spatial. This is just exactly what it looks like. Now these things could be any kind of quantum object at the vertices. If it's a rebit, I'm going to try to connect that to U1, the U1 gauge group, because rebits can rotate in their plane by something just like that. A qubit, if a qubit, the analogy is going to be the SU2 gauge group, and if qutrit, the SU3 gauge group. And so I'm trying to make an analogy between this lattice of quantum objects and lattice gauge theory. It's particularly what I was just talking about. So I want to ask these questions. First of all, can we define a notion of parallel transport based on the state of these quantum objects? So the whole lattice has some quantum state, say some density matrix. Does the state automatically define a notion of parallel transport? That's question number one. And then if so, is it possible to have non-trivial UPs? That is, when you go around a closed loop, can you not get back to where you started using the definition of parallel transport? It might seem odd that you could do that since there's a definitely a unique state there, rho, the density matrix of the whole thing. And finally, if this is true and this is true, if there is such a thing as non-trivial UPs, or twisting, then is there a cost, in the same way that in lattice gauge theories you have this action cost, do you have an entanglement cost? Do you have to pay for that twisting with a lower entanglement, the way in lattice gauge theories you pay for the twisting with a lower probability? Are these kind of interesting questions? I mean, what are they good for? That I don't know. But I think it's sort of interesting. So, all right, so let me just say more about, let's get to the first question, which is this parallel transport business. But first I need to say what a rebit is. Again, it's this quantum bit or real vector space, quantum mechanics. So like this, like photon polarization that can only be linear polarization and not elliptical or circular. Or what I'll use, it's a little bit better, it's equivalent, just an electron with its spin confined to the horizontal plane. Any plane will do, but the horizontal plane is the simplest to work with because then these states just look like, you know, equal superpositions up and down with some phase factor. I'll tell you more what the angle is. It's a little bit subtle because when you have lots of these things, you have to make sure that when you rotate back into the XZ plane where you want everything to be real, that everything is real. There can't be any complex numbers left. So there's some condition for that, which I'll not go into any more detail. Okay. Now, first question then is, can you define parallel transport? How an entangled rebit state can define parallel transport? Okay, so I'm going to have three examples of these states. The first one's what I call the identity state. It's kind of like the singlet state. The singlet state of two qubits, of course, if you measure one of them and it ends up pointing in this direction, then it'll collapse the other one into that direction, the opposite direction. These rebits are even better because they have this identity state where if you make a measurement on particle A, so here this is supposed to be the horizontal plane in which the rebit lives, you make the measurement plus versus minus. If you get the answer plus, then lo and behold, B will also be forced into the plus state. So I want to associate with this state the identity operator. Okay? And then there's the twisted identity state. So you same thing, but with a phase factor thrown in here. Then you measure A, and it forces A into one state or the other. And if it forces it into plus, for example, then B will be forced into plus rotated by this angle phi. Okay? Rotate around the z-axis in the right-handed sense. If A goes into this state, B will go into the same rotation time applied to the minus state. Okay, so then I want to associate this rotation with this state. I mean, this business of associating transformations with states is not new, and I think it's probably shown up in a number of talks this week. Okay. One more example. Again, this is just to remind you what I'm talking about, how a state can define parallel transport. The twisted Werner state. So here's our twisted state, twisted identity from the last slide. Consider this density matrix for A and B. It's got this F times this, this nice state, plus 1 minus F, F is between 0 and 1, times the completely mixed state. Okay, that would be like a Werner state if this were a singlet and this was a completely mixed state. It'd be like a Werner state for qubits. Except I'm also allowing myself to add on any amount of this state consistent with the conditions for a density matrix because this matrix won't make any difference for anything that we say. So I'm still calling it a Werner state if it has some of that. This is a very rebit kind of fact. Okay, so now you measure particle A, if the two are in this state, if A comes out plus, then B afterwards is a mixed state. It's a mixture of the rotated plus and the completely mixed state for the rebit. Okay, and with F telling you how much of the good thing you have, and 1 minus F telling you how much of the thing you don't want. Okay, and let me just write down, by the way, the density matrix, 4x4 density matrix, for one of these twisted Werner states. And the main reason I write it down is just to point out that this element, this matrix element here, this is in the standard up-down basis, which I know are not allowed states for rebits, of course. Up and down are not allowed, but we can still write in that basis. This element contains all the information we care about. The phi tells you how much twisting there is, and the F is sort of how strongly connected the two rebits are, or the correlation between them. Now we'll associate R phi with passage from A to B if phi appears there. Okay, so that's how I'm going to associate transformations with states. Now, but the question is, are they going to, are two neighboring rebits going to be in one of these twisted Werner states? And no, they won't in general, but they will be if I impose one condition, which is I insist that the state of the whole lattice be invariant under simultaneous rotation by the same angle of all the qubits, all the rebits. Okay, so that it be invariant like that, that forces the pairwise density matrix into the form that we had above. It's not hard to see that. And so I'm going to insist on that. And so that means that for that kind of system, we can define parallel transport. Okay? So if, oh, except that if F has to be not zero. If F was zero, which is this correlation between two rebits, then there's no connection between them. You can't define any parallel transport between them. So F has to be not zero. But then you can define the state has a notion of parallel transport. Okay, now so we've got parallel transport there. Now our other questions, recall, were, first of all, is non-trivial parallel transport possible? Can you go around and come back to not where you started? And if so, is there this entanglement cost that I was wondering about? Okay, and so now we go to part four of the talk. We're making good time. Entangled rings. Okay, because this is a case where those questions can all be answered completely and exactly. Okay, so here's a ring of rebits. There's rebit number J there. And with this link here, with any link in this chain, there's going to be a pairwise density matrix here. And that pairwise density matrix will define a notion of parallel transport from J to J plus 1. And phi J is what does that. Okay, there's this angle associated with that, as we've seen. And there's also an FJ, which tells you how strongly linked they are. Okay. And I want to define two sort of conglomerate quantities out of those. This average F is going to be the average of the Fs all the way around the ring. And this net phi, the net rotation, is the net rotation around the ring, the sum of all the phis, log 2 pi. And our questions now become, and I'm going to use this average F as my figure of merit for how connected, how the ring is, how correlated the neighbors are. I might add that there's a wonderful formula for entanglement formation in the paper by Caves and others, which I'm not using, okay, because this is easier. This is easier, okay. For the first pass, I want to do the easy thing, and F is the easy thing to work with. So F is my figure of merit of connectedness. So our questions are, can the net rotation be non-zero? Okay, now, can you have non-trivial parallel transport around the ring? And then if so, let's find the script F of the net phase to be the maximum of this average S, F, over all states of the ring, all density matrices of the ring that are consistent with the phi net. Okay? So you're given phi net, you look over all the states of the ring that are consistent with that and find the one that has the best connection. We call that's the connection associated, the degree of connection associated with phi net. And the question is then, does this sort of entanglement or correlation, really is a more proper word, does this degree of correlation diminish as phi net goes away from zero? Assuming that's possible. We haven't demonstrated it at all, but that's possible. So now we're going to do an example and see if we can get that. See if we can get non-trivial parallel transport. N equals 4. So 4 rebits. So here's a state which I just plot down here. And one can show, just jumping to the answer here, one can show that this thing maximizes the average F, the average connectedness of nearest neighbors, if you don't put any other constraints on. You don't, no constraint about phases or anything. And that average F is about 70%. So F goes up to 1. F goes from 0 to 1. So this is 70% correlated. Okay, 1 over root 2. And also, this thing has 0 net phase. So we have not yet got anything with a phase. Now consider the following thing. Oh, by the way, this is also the ground state of the XY model. This is very closely related to the XY model. And this is exactly soluble for the same reason that the one-dimensional XY model is also exactly soluble. Though it's not the same problem, because we have this twist which the XY model doesn't have. Okay, now consider this state. We take the one that we had before, okay, and we start to twist it. We just apply rotations to the rebits. We rotate this one by 90 degrees, this by 180 degrees, this by 270 degrees, okay? And what does that do? Well, it doesn't change any of the connections because those are local transformations. They don't change the correlation between two, the degree of connectedness between two rebits. Also, each of the phis now, say from here to here, is now pi over 2, okay? Go from pi over 2, pi over 2. And this is also pi over 2. The net phase is still 0. Okay, so we haven't really, because 2 pi is the same as 0. We still haven't gotten anything that's not trivial. And you can check that you can throw any kind of rotations you want in there, it's always going to do the same thing. We still don't know if you can do better. That if you can do this non-trivial, wouldn't that be funny? And I say, no, you can't do it, and that's the end of the talk. that would be really implausible, wouldn't it? And so there's this other question: what if we could do it? Then we could have asked this question, but we can't. So, no, but actually you can. You can do it. One way to get non-zero phi net is simply to take an incoherent mixture of these two states that I had on the preceding slide. Remember that one of them, they both had F, fidelity or whatever, 1 over root 2. But this one, the first one, had zero phase when you went from over through one link. Okay, the next one had a phase of I, pi over 2 phase, as you went over one link. So that when you went over four of them, you got back to zero again. But if you're just talking about one link, and you add these two together, you're adding the density matrices together, and remember that component of the density matrix I was pointing to earlier. When you add those, you take an average of those. You're taking an average of this number and this complex number. Okay, so it's going to be here somewhere with these weights. And so now you will have a non-trivial phase associated with that link. And if you do it four times, you go around all four links, you're going to have a net phase that's not zero. It's four of that, and that could be anything. And there will be a fidelity associated with that, which is clearly less than what you had here or here. And then there's a theorem here's where I'm just cutting to the chase. You can't do better than that. Okay, anything else you try is not going to do any better than this. So this really is true. So this is the answer then, at least for the four states, for four rebits. You do have you pay an entanglement cost, if you will, or a correlation cost by having this net phase. And so that's what that shows. And now I'll just give you the answer for large N, okay? You can do this exactly for any N. And in the large N limit, this connectedness factor, this connectedness number, still varies with the net phase. And it goes down as you go away from zero, comes back up as you get to 2 pi. And then there's this 1 over n squared, which means this whole thing sort of shrinks to this line when n goes to infinity. So for very large n, you don't pay much of a cost. Okay. Anyway, that's what you find. Okay. Now, and that's the end of actual results, things that I know. And now I'll spend a couple of minutes just talking about things I don't know. So what if you did it in a lattice instead of a ring? That was the interesting case that we're really after. What's the problem? Anyway, how do you specify the problem on this lattice? Well, I guess what you would do is you'd specify some rotation to it. These are still rebits. Some rotation that you would associate with each link, okay? And then you would say, And that we call the field, the quote field configuration, because it plays the role of the field configuration. Now you consider all density matrices of the lattice, rho, that yield those parallel transporters, okay? And maximizing over all such rho, you find the biggest possible average connectedness. And so then the question would be, what is that function? Okay, as the it's kind of the analog of this, or related to the action of the lattice gauge theory. We can do similar tricks. We can take a little plaquette and do this kind of thing, and maybe add, and probably have to add up a bunch of others to get the right answer. But anyway, this can't be. This just consider these four particles by themselves. The fact that they're connected to the rest of the lattice doesn't matter. You can't do any better than what we already did for a ring of four. So there definitely is some loss of correlation. There's some cost here for the lattice as well. Okay, and I'm almost ready to conclude here. I don't have much more to say. Let me just look at what's going on here. What is this construction doing? Okay, we got quantum mechanics, but with no Hamiltonian specified. That's characteristic of all these entanglement sharing problems. There's no Hamiltonian. We're just saying, what can you do if you could make Hamiltonians however you wanted to? And there are certain restrictions just coming from quantum mechanics, just the structure of the theory. And we throw that in. We throw in a particular lattice geometry. And we throw in a type of object, rebit, qubit, qtrit, whatever. And then out comes this function. Some twisting instructions, and for any set of twisting instructions, you have this sort of connectedness. And the connectedness seems to go down as you increase the amount of twisting, just as the probability goes down as you increase the amount of twisting in a gauge field configuration. Okay, so there is a kind of an analogy there anyway. Obviously, there are a lot more questions. It has to be spelled out a lot better. That's just the very beginning. And it's not clear how tight the analogy is. So here are conclusions. For rebits, anyway, twisting does cost correlation, apparently. But this is kind of, I don't like this. For small phi, you notice that the delta F went, the F went down linearly with phi, okay? Whereas in these gauge theories, the action always goes to phi squared. Of course, I can always say that the analog of action is delta F squared, no, right? I could certainly do that if I want to make the analogy. Some questions. Well, can we do this with qubits? How hard is that? I want to think about other measures of correlation or entanglement, like maybe the Cave's measure of entanglement might be better than this crude measure of correlation that I've been using. And there's this question, which I asked to head off that question from many members of the audience. So what's it good for? Okay, that's a good question. I give that to you as an exercise. Okay, thanks very much. That's it.
Okay. Yes?
You asked me a couple of days ago about the ground state of the anti-ferromagnetic isotope.
Yes, right, yeah.
Does that have anything to do with this?
Well, you can see it's sort of related. Because these, when I go to two dimensions. I mean, there I was basically solving the XY model in one dimension in order to get some of these states. Anti-ferromagnetic XY model. But when we go to two dimensions or three dimensions, then one has to, work out similar things for those lattices. Yes, so it does have something to do with it. But I haven't really even begun to work on that.
I mean, it just wasn't clear what this had to do with refining
ground states. Oh, right. Oh, yeah, I see. It wasn't clear. Right. Okay, why? Yes, okay, because the correlation, maybe we can have, no, let's see. Okay, I'll write on this. Yes, I can write on this. So this F that we're talking about, or rather this F, that kind of thing, this thing, F, is equal to a trace of the density matrix of the lattice times this kind of operator. You can write it this way, where those are like creation annihilation operators, or up, raising and lower, up and down. And that starts to look like the the XY model. It's like you take the Hermitian part of this and you get the Hamiltonian for the XY model. So that's there is this kind of relation. And the easiest way to solve these problems is to do it with this kind of notation. Yes? Oh, sorry.
You gave that figure 0.434
yes.
for the maximum in a ring, but you didn't say that depends on the number in the ring.
Oh, absolutely. That's asymptotic. Thank you for the question. It's asymptotic. But it approaches it pretty quickly, it seems to. It's very simple. It tends to go down. The more you add to the ring, the more you're asking, the more you're demanding of the entanglement sharing. Entanglement has to be shared a little more broadly.
This might be a really foolish question, I'm not sure, but you showed the smallest ring was a 4.
Oh, yes.
Ring. Can you do it with 3?
Oh, it's a good question. That's something I completely forgot to mention, which is that this condition that I've imposed, which is invariance under simultaneous rotation of all the particles, means that they're going to be in an eigenstate of spin in the z direction, and the Rebic condition makes it an eigenstate with spin in the z direction equal to 0. And you have to have an even number of particles. Okay, so, and I also noticed just before giving the talk that all my little diagrams of rings had an odd number of particles except for the 4. When I had a lot of numbers, it was 21 or 15 or something. So that was just a mistake. I'm sure that's what you were thinking of.
There's another question, but I have one more. The entanglement cost, the cost of this phase, goes down, it seems, as your number of qubits in the room.
Yes, absolutely. That's right. So if you, yeah.
Is it fair to sort of think about that as coming from the fact that for a large number of qubits, there's a whole lot more potential links that if you didn't have the ring structure, you could have. And that perhaps in higher dimensions, the number of dimensions that you arrange your latticing goes up with the number of qubits and like that will keep your entanglement cost.
I don't think of it that way. I mean, there may be a way to think of it that way. I think of it this way. For n equals 4, remember we had this 90 degree triangle we were interpolating between these two points. N equals 6, we're going to have a 30-degree thing and interpolate between those two. And as n gets larger, you're going to be interpolating between two points that are closer together. And so therefore, you don't have to go so far within the circle to get from here to there. Do you see what I'm saying? You don't have to get so close to the origin to go from here to here. So as n increases, that's what's going on.
During lunch and put the pins in the room. Thank you, speaker.